This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Sudan, April 2023. Another country, another evacuation, another set of pictures of exhausted, relieved British passengers touching down on safe soil. But what about the tens of millions left behind and the country they call home? What's their history and how does their future look? To put it simply, once all British nationals are safe, does what happens in Sudan matter to us? And if so, why? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, a geography and history primer. James Copnall is the presenter of Newsday on the BBC World Service and he was formerly our correspondent in Sudan.
It's often seen as the bridge between the African and the Arab worlds. So in the northeast corner of Africa, Egypt and Libya to the north, South Sudan to the south, it's seen as a gateway between those two parts of the African continent. It's rich in terms of agriculture. It's been described as the breadbasket of the Arab world. It had oil in the past. It's got a lot of gold now. So it has resources. But it's a very, very poor country, certainly by British standards. It's almost entirely Muslim now, though there are some Christian communities and people who follow traditional religions in the Nuba Mountains. But religion and what should be the state religion have been vital parts of Sudan's drama and crises over the last many decades, actually.
How many people live there and how are they distributed around the country?
It's close to 40 million now, I think. The majority of them probably live on it, one of its big geographical features. So you've got the Blue Nile coming in from Ethiopia and the White Nile coming up from South Sudan. And they meet at Khartoum, the capital, and they flow up towards Egypt as the Nile. And so around that big river, you have some fertile agricultural land. And so people have always lived in between the two rivers, either side of the Nile, as it kind of meanders its way up towards Egypt. And then further out, you get fairly remote deserts, for example, in Darfur in the west, slightly more lush, fertile, hilly areas to the south. But the biggest population concentration by far is in Khartoum, in the capital, 7 or 8 million, something like that, in the three or four big towns that make up the heart of the Sudanese state.
Let's go back 100 years, say. Was Sudan a country then? And if it was, who ruled it?
It's a rather strange arrangement called the Anglo-Egyptian Condominium. So essentially, Britain and Egypt. The Brits were basically in control at the heart of every key decision, but they were also more or less in control of Egypt, but pretending they weren't. And so there was this facade of the British and the Egyptians being in control, and you would see Egyptian military officers or colonial officers. But essentially, the British were taking all the major decisions.
Right. And then Sudan became a country in its own right and became independent when?
1st of January 1956. There was a period where it seemed possible that Sudan would join Egypt and become one with Egypt. But one of its great tensions from its early days was between the north, which was dominated by Arab speakers and Muslims, and the south, which was dominated by people who saw themselves as Africans and who followed Christianity or traditional religions. And they were keener on perhaps joining Kenya or Uganda, moving towards the south. And so there's this huge tension. Sudan became independent, but within these tensions contained within it. And so even before independence at the start of 1956, the first north-south civil war broke out. And there were ultimately two very, very long civil wars before South Sudan seceded in 2011.
Right. Can you just tell us about those two civil wars and how religious and ethnic divisions played out in those wars?
So there are a lot of different ethnic groups in Sudan, but the people who've always controlled the state in one way or another come from just two or three ethnic groups who see their origins in the Arab world, who saw themselves as Muslim, and who wanted to push a Arab and Islamic identity on the whole of the country. And that was resisted in different ways, not just in north-south conflicts where it was most pronounced, perhaps, because the people of the south were largely not Muslim, did not see themselves as Arabs, and saw that as an imposition on their way of life and the way they wanted to live. But it also happened, for example, in the later civil war in Darfur that broke out in 2003, people might remember was called the first genocide of the 21st century. And there were non-Arab groups who felt an Arab identity was being pushed on them, or at least Arab groups were dominating them. So conflicts over ethnicity, conflicts over religion, and I think also conflicts over resources and development. So the further you go away from the centre, from Khartoum and the fertile agricultural lands around there and the ethnic groups that have always controlled the state, the less developed it is.
Now, I think a lot of listeners may remember that there was a dictator of Sudan until fairly recently. Tell us a bit about him, how he came to power and how he lost power.
Omar al-Bashir, yeah. So he took power in 1989 in a coup. He was a relatively unknown military officer at the time. And it's probably worth pointing out that the military have been in charge in Sudan for most of its history. There have been democratic interludes, but they've been short ones. The norm in Sudan has been a man in a military uniform in control. But Omar al-Bashir lasted far longer than anyone else. So he took power. He was backed by Islamist politicians who wanted to impose a very hardline version of Islamicized political rule in the country. Osama bin Laden was a guest in Sudan in the earlier years of Omar al-Bashir's time in power. And so he was there for 30 years. And during those 30 years, there wasn't a single day of peace in South Sudan. There was the fighting in Darfur. There were rebellions in South Kordofan and Blue Nile in the south and in the east of Sudan as well. So constant conflict in one form or another. But things got tougher and tougher for Omar al-Bashir after the secession of South Sudan in 2011 because the oil revenue was in the south. The Sudanese economy started struggling. People got more and more frustrated. And from late 2018 through early 2019, there was this huge wave of popular protests, very brave citizens taking to the street and saying, we don't want Omar al-Bashir. We don't want the military in power anymore. We want civilian rule. So in April 2019, he was overthrown, but not entirely by the people. Some of his own generals stepped in. The idea was to take the country towards genuine democracy, free and fair elections. But in late 2021, the military stepped in, the Sudanese armed forces under General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and this very, very powerful paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, under Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who's known as Hameti. They carried out a coup, and they have been ruling ever since until the clashes between them broke out in the last few days.
Can I just ask you a brief question about the people who effectively got Bashir ousted? Did they just have the appearance of power temporarily to create a democracy, or did they really represent a significant trend within the country?
It was a really significant trend within the country, and I guess the greatest flowering of that sort of moment was this huge, what they called a sit-in, outside the headquarters of the military in the centre of Khartoum. the civilian protesters set up their own area that they were in control of. There were people who picked up the rubbish so things didn't get too messy. There were free lessons for school kids so that they could not miss out on their education, street kids as well, so they could take part in the revolution. There were speeches and discussions and debates about the future of the country. And these were the people who were pushing for civilian rule. And, you know, they came pretty close. But ultimately, the military stepped in to make sure that didn't happen.
Taking us up to the present day, these two people who are now fighting each other, why has the accord that they had with each other not persisted?
I think, first of all, personal ambition. They both position themselves in different ways. So Hameti says the army general is an Islamist. He wants to bring back the remnants of Omar al-Bashir's regime. He wants to reinstall them at the head of the state. General Burhan and his supporters see Hameti as this provincial warlord, essentially. They both, I think it's significant to say, also have a huge amount to lose. So the military are heavily involved in most areas of the Sudanese economy. And Hameti and his RSF, this paramilitary group, he has huge interests in gold and things like that. So they've both got rich because of their positions. And they're both accused of carrying out atrocities and abuses in Darfur and elsewhere, which means backing down is extremely difficult.
James Cottenall. So let's bring ourselves up to date with what's been happening in Sudan in the last few days. The Briefing Room's Ben Carter spoke to World Service journalist Mohamed Hashim, who is himself Sudanese.
Mo, what do we know about what's currently happening in Khartoum?
The situation on the ground is very bad. Many people are on the move trying to get out of the city. There are no functioning hospitals. Most of the markets have been damaged or destroyed in the fighting. No pharmacies. There's no transport. People are very afraid. The routes that people are taking across the city to reach safety are very limited. Many people are trying to escape the fighting by going either to the Egyptian borders in the north. But now news is trickling that there is a very bad humanitarian situation for tens or hundreds of thousands that are currently stuck on the Argin border crossing with Egypt. Many people have managed to find a way to Port Sudan on the Red Sea coast, where they are hoping to be evacuated or find boats or ferries to take them to Saudi Arabia. But there is also an atmosphere of lawlessness that is spreading in around the city. While the two armies at the moment are not engaged in a full-out war, because although there is some fighting, the ceasefire is kind of like precarious, but in the state of lawlessness that has ensued the initial fighting, areas in Khartoum North, the industrial area in Khartoum North, for example, where most of the food factories, the medicine factories and these kind of things, they have been looted. We have seen videos on social media of factories being burned, grain stores being looted. This is the situation in Khartoum. The situation in Darfur is much worse. There is heavy fighting reported in West Darfur in the city called Jenina, where the police is reported to have opened their gun stores for civilians to protect themselves from attacks, which has triggered a wave of tribal clashes along ethnic lines between Arab tribes and some of the city residents. The situation in South Darfur, where Niala, Sudan's second largest city, is also bad. There has been heavy fighting there between the armed forces and the RSF. And again, we're hearing reports of looting from there. So I think the situation overall is not good.
There's been speculation surrounding the whereabouts of the former Sudanese leader Omar al-Bashir, who was in prison. Do we know where he is now?
He is actually in the military hospital in Omdurman receiving treatment. Omar al-Bashir is someone in his late 70s and he has been receiving frequent medical treatment in the army hospital.
Is there any sense that he's in any way influencing what's happening in Sudan now?
I would say no. But I would say some of his loyalists and supporters who lost much of their influence and clout after the 2019 revolution have been spoiling or trying to sabotage the transition process are definitely stand to gain if the battle goes the military's way, because the Islamist National Congress Party still has a considerable number of loyalists within the armed forces.
Mo, you grew up in Khartoum. What are your hopes and fears for what happens in the next few days and weeks?
It's a difficult question to answer. I'm very upset and quite broken to think that the city I grew up in has been destroyed like this. I grew up in an area called Khartoum 2 or K2. It was a hot zone in the start of this war. It's an area where many diplomats and international soldiers live. It's an area that's an RSF stronghold. I am not optimistic. I think we haven't seen the worst of this conflict yet. I hope it stops, but I doubt it. My family came to Khartoum plus or minus 150 years ago. Now most of my family are refugees. Our people on the move trying to find a place to hide, to shelter. I fear that looking at Sudan's long history, the RSF and what they're doing in Khartoum is a case of chicken coming home to roost. Khartoum has been exporting violence to the various parts of Sudan over 7 decades. And in a way, the challenge that is posed by the constituency from which the RSF comes from is in a way a legitimate challenge. These were marginalized communities in the desert with a pastoralist lifestyle has been greatly impacted over the last 3-4 decades by desertification, climate change. Their ways of life have altered completely. 20 years ago, they were armed to the teeth and subcontracted to do the army's bidding and fighting insurgents in Darfur. That caused a triggered ethnic cleansing that was described as a genocide. Now, if the same ethnic mobilization continues, then the worst is to come.
Mo Hashim. So now we know a bit more about Sudan and how the current crisis began. But what does this mean for the future of the country, the surrounding region, and for the rest of us? Joining me in the briefing room are Dame Rosalind Marsden, Associate Fellow at the Chatham House International Affairs Think Tank and a former UK ambassador to Sudan, and Professor Alex de Waal, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation and Research Programme Director with the Conflict Research Programme at the London School of Economics. Rosalind Marsden, we've heard quite a lot of talk about how the Americans should get involved in Sudan to broker ceasefires, to help out. Why should the Americans get involved in Sudan?
Well, Sudan is an important country for the West, for the United States, for the UK, for a number of reasons. One is that it's now the third largest country in Africa. It's very strategically located between the Sahel and the Horn of Africa. And many of the neighbouring countries, which are around 7, have got internal conflicts of their own. So if there were to be an escalation of the current fighting in Sudan, it would turn into a prolonged civil war. This could be very destabilising for the region. Sudan's also geopolitically located on the Red Sea coast, which is very important for strategic reasons. And then I think the other point to stress is that after the revolution of 2019 that overthrew Bashir, there were real hopes that Sudan was a country that might be able to make a transition over time to democracy. And if that succeeded, it could even become a model for the region. So there's been strong Western sort of backing and investment in the political process in Sudan over the last few years.
Alex, is that broadly how you see it, that obviously there's been a concentration in this country on the evacuation and other countries of their own nationals, but that once that has happened, we retain a significant interest in what happens to the Sudanese themselves?
I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, it is quite terrifying to see what is happening with the evacuation of the Sudanese themselves from their capital city, a city of 7 million. And it is the predominant city in the country. It dominates the economy, it dominates the politics. And if it collapses, the refugee flows, apart from anything else, are going to be absolutely calamitous.
In that case, can I ask you both, who is most likely to be able to broker some kind of peace in this situation? Rosalind?
Well, some of the regional countries, particularly South Sudan, Kenya and Djibouti, have already been mandated by IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, to try to broker a ceasefire, initially starting with trying to extend the humanitarian truce to let foreign nationals and Sudanese civilians get out, and then hoping to turn that into an extended, more permanent ceasefire. Obviously, in addition to that, the United States, the UK, Norway, who are the sort of Western troika, have been coordinating as with the European Union and other Western governments to put pressure on both sides. I think one of the crucial things is that all these international and regional efforts should be well coordinated. I know from talking to my Sudanese contacts amongst the civilian political leaders and the civil society activists, they're very concerned that all these efforts to mediate should not be fragmented, so you get different mediators giving different messages to different people. Also that the civilians themselves should have some voice in the process.
Alex, when you look at the situation, do you not ask yourself what is there to mediate here? I mean, in other words, what possible agreement can you try and get to with these two people and these two forces that don't seem to have any kind of connection with civil society as such, but seem to be, exist in their own kind of almost gangsterish right?
I think that's absolutely the problem. We have what is essentially a mobster shootout. We have two generals, each of them head of their own kleptocratic networks, these vast, militarized, commercialized outfits engaged in all sorts of illicit and corrupt activities, who basically want to run Sudan for their own personal and political and factional benefit. And yes, the immediate challenge is getting them to stop fighting, stop destroying the capital city, stop the destruction of all civilian life in Sudan. But a truce between them, a power sharing between them, would snuff out the prospects for democracy and would set Sudan back many, many years. It would be, I think, another generation before we began to see the prospects of Sudan re-emerging as a democracy. So what is decided in the next few days is going to be absolutely crucial for the future of the country.
So, Rosalind, that suggests that actually the brokering of a peace between these two groups has its downsides.
Well, what the fighting over the last 12 or 13 days has demonstrated to most Sudanese is that their view, which was already pretty strong, that the military leaders couldn't be trusted, they certainly don't want them involved in the political life any longer, has been absolutely vindicated. I mean, this has been the main demand of the young revolutionaries who've been showing such courage in demonstrating against military rule, that they want a civilian government. There was some scepticism about the attempt to broker a political framework agreement between the civilian politicians and the military. There was some hope that that nevertheless might constrain these military leaders by pulling them into a political process, however great the challenges. But I think what they've done, the two military sides, by showing complete disregard for the safety and welfare of the civilians, has really destroyed any possible trust in them as good faith actors.
We've talked a little bit about how outside forces might help bring about a peace, temporary or longer term. What about the interest in some outside forces in prolonging the fight or backing, giving backing to one or other of the two parties?
A number of outside actors have their favourites. So Egypt is very clearly in favour of General Burhan, head of the Sudan Armed Forces. The United Arab Emirates and General Khalifa Haftar in Libya have been close allies of General Hemeti, the head of the Rapid Support Forces. But that said, none of them wanted this war. This is a war that there was complete consensus across the regional and international community that it would be a disaster. The danger is that if there is not a very rapid end to the fighting, that those outside parties will provide money, arms, fuel, and political support to their favourites, and therefore that it will become a much more entangled and intractable problem.
OK, we did a programme on the Briefing Room recently on the Wagner Group in Ukraine, and one of the things that we were told was that this group was active in Africa. Do we know whether it's been at all active in Sudan, Rosalind?
Well, yes, it has. I mean, as we know, the Russians are trying to expand their footprint in Africa at the moment, and Sudan seems to be one of their target countries. The Wagner group is known to have quite close links with General Hemeti and the Rapid Support Force. They've in the past been providing some training and advice. When I was in Khartoum early last year, you could see many of the Russians from the Wagner group around in Khartoum. They've also, of course, got a major interest in Sudan's gold mining operations, as have some other Russian companies. So there is that connection. But I don't think one should look at the Russian interest just through the prism of the Wagner Group. There's also an interest by the Russian government in trying to establish a naval base on the Red Sea, which they initially negotiated with former President Bashir in 2017. And they've been trying since the revolution to see if they can still proceed with that. But that has been held up. There's resistance from the region, of course, also from the West.
Alex, we heard from Mohamed Hashim about the queues currently at the border with Egypt, the crossing with Egypt, and people making for Port Sudan. If a lot of people are moving out of Sudan, where are they going to end up?
The immediate refugee flows will be to Egypt and the neighbouring countries. But we can expect to see them looking further afield. They will be coming to Europe, and many of them have links to the United Kingdom and will be wanting to come here.
So if the fighting continues, is it at all realistic to put an estimate on how many people will be displaced?
Millions.
Millions of people?
Millions of people.
Has there been any significant role for British diplomacy in Sudan recently?
Sadly, rather little. Britain is part of the so-called Quad of the headed by the United States with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, but its role has been rather secondary, which is a sad contrast to the situation 10, 12 years ago when Rosalind Marsden was the EU Special Envoy and I was working with the African Union. And then it was possible because the UK government had clout within the EU in multilateral fora and a significant aid budget. It was possible to get the sort of high-level political attention that was necessary to stop crises such as these unfolding. Now, unfortunately, Britain is much on the sidelines and can only bemoan the refugees that will be coming our way.
Rosalind Marsden, do you see any reason beyond this bout of fighting for optimism given the changes that have happened in Sudan?
Well, I think one important point to bear in mind about the context of the fighting that's now going on is that it should be seen in the context of a political struggle for democratic transformation between the pro-democracy movement on the one hand and what people refer to in Sudan as the remnants of the old regime, the Bashir regime, who want to derail Sudan's democratic transition. And it seems are hoping to return to power, perhaps on the back of what they hope will be a military victory for the army. And this is all linked to the fact that the so-called deep state, the Islamists who were appointed during the Bashir era and the Bashir loyalists, survived after the revolution. I mean, some were removed, but many remained in the civil service, in the security service, in the army. Since the October 2021 military coup against the civilian government of Prime Minister Hamdok, even more of these people have come back into positions of power. And very interestingly, over the last few months and weeks, we've seen the Islamists, the members of the former regime, becoming increasingly visible in public. During Ramadan, they held various iftars in which they were publicly calling for the release of former President Omar al-Bashir. And the civilian democratic leaders are sort of pointing to this and saying, this demonstrates the warning we've been giving you for some long time, that this is a war that's been instigated by, you know, the former regime elements trying to get back into power again.
But, Alex, isn't the problem here, therefore, that the Democrats, if we kind of use that term very broadly, are the only people who don't seem to have guns?
That's absolutely the problem. The Democrats and the local resistance committees, committees of doctors and so on, they are the ones organising on the ground humanitarian assistance, getting supplies, sharing information about where people can move safely. So they're the ones actually with some form of civic government below the radar. They're the people who should be supported, but they don't have much power at the moment.
How can we support them?
I think the most important thing is very clear messaging that from the very highest level, that this type of warlordism, gangsterism is totally unacceptable, and what we need to do is to return to a democratic transition.
Alex de Waal there with Dame Rosalind Marsden. My thanks to them and James Copnell and Mo Hashim. So, what's my conclusion? Well, Sudan does indeed matter, and it's in our interest to strengthen those political forces in the country who don't try and impose their will gangster style. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Claire Bowes. The editor was Penny Murphy, and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, but if you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and listen to the entire back catalogue, including the one asking whether we should worry about the AI revolution, the one about how we fix Britain's railways, and the one on the threat posed by avian flu.
Hi, I'm Helen Lewis, and I want to tell you about a podcast I've made for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. It's called The New Gurus, and it's about how everywhere you look on the internet, people are giving advice. Advice they claim will transform your life. Advice that gets them thousands, no, millions of devoted followers. These online prophets are telling us how to eat, how to think, how to get rich, how to find love, how to manage our time. These are the new gurus.
Just as people will say the Protestant Reformation and the printing press went hand in hand, so too did this birth of the new internet culture really give rise to this new religious landscape.
Subscribe now to The New Gurus on BBC Sounds.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.